Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Instead, prepare to learn that everything you thought you knew about the history of the game of Monopoly is wrong. That is, unless you're one of the lucky people who've already read Mary Pallon's new book, The Monopolists. Mary Pallon joins me now in the studio. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to start with what we think we know about Monopoly. According to Parker Brothers lore, during the Great Depression, a salesman named Charles Darrow was out of work, struggling to feed his family, when he headed down to his basement with an idea. And I think I'll let you tell the story from there.
Right. So the idea was that this guy, you know, during the Depression, times are tough. He goes into his basement. He innovates. He creates this game. And Parker Brothers at the time was also reeling, like a lot of companies. He creates this game, Monopoly. It becomes a mega bestseller. Everybody becomes fabulously rich, and it's a fantastic, happy Cinderella, Horatio Alger tale.
Well, the real story, and I'm going to try to get it right, Charles Darrow actually copied the game from some friends who had played the game with fellow Quakers, who had learned the game from a couple of guys who had played in college, completely unaware that the whole thing traced back to a woman named Lizzie McGee.
Correct. That's very good. The game actually originated with a woman in 1904, long before, obviously, the Great Depression. She received a patent for her landlord's game in 1904, and from there, the game just becomes very popular among a who's who of left-wing America, and it's much more of a folk game, so people adapt it and modify it. There's Boston copies of the game, there's Philadelphia copies of the game, New York, and it's a version of one of those games that actually the Atlantic City Quakers had modified, which is why we have the Atlantic City properties on today's Monopoly board, that Charles Darrow plays.
And the point of Lizzie's game was to prove that our economic system was bad, right?
Right. She was a follower of Henry George, who was a political economist at the time, who actually he had died a little bit before she had created her game, who was protesting against the landlords at the time. I mean, this was the progressive era. So you had Carnegie, Rockefeller. You had a lot of people kind of reacting to this amount of wealth that had been created and kind of questioning how it was going to be distributed. Sometimes they refer to these parties as anti-monopoly parties. So Lizzie McGee creates this game as a teaching tool to show the evils of the landlords and the evils of the monopolists.
When Parker Brother bought the game from Charles Darrow for $7,000 plus residuals in 1935, they probably didn't know that the game was already 30 years old. But the company immediately set out to create this paper trail to establish the work as Darrow's. Why were they so paranoid?
Well, I think that it's important to remember when we look at all of this history, including Lizzie McGee and the early players, that nobody knew they were sitting on a blockbuster and a thing that we would still be talking about, you know, all this time later. So they tried to buy up other versions of the game because Darrow wasn't the first person who tried to sell the game on his own. You know, obviously Lizzie McGee had sold her landlord's game. There was a guy named Dan Lehman who sold a game called Finance. There was a guy named Rudy Copeland who had sold a game called Inflation out of Texas. So there were other versions of the game on the market, and their rival, Milton Bradley, actually had a game called Easy Money. So they try to get control of all of the other similar games.
The Quakers who had taught Darrow how to play the game obviously knew from the beginning that it didn't belong to him. But
right.
Why didn't they put up a fight?
The Quakers, they modified the game in some kind of key ways that we would know. Obviously, the Atlantic City properties, they made it simpler. They were playing it with children. But their view that came out much later was, well, we didn't invent it either. And usually if you're disputing who invented it, you're saying, I invented it. This guy didn't. But the Quakers just had played it organically. So they didn't know by the time they were playing it, the connection to Lizzie McGee was muddled or maybe even lost altogether.
We might never have known this story if not for Ralph Ansbach, an economics professor at San Francisco State. He sued for the right to produce his own game called Anti-Monopoly and spent a decade hunting down everyone who had played this game before Darrow, quote unquote, invented it. I have to think, though, some of his quest had to be due to his own curiosity.
Absolutely. I mean, Ralph, before this, he was very politically motivated, ironically, a lot like Lizzie McGee was. And he was very involved in the anti-war movement, which was obviously a big focal point in the Bay Area in the late 60s and early 70s. He himself had fled Danzig shortly before Hitler claimed power and then came to the U.S. as an immigrant. So he had this pattern in his own life of fighting for things. His sense of purpose with this case was so dead on the entire time in a way that it took me a long time to kind of think about that and report that out.
Ansbach went deeply into debt. It basically ruined his marriage. He missed large portions of his kids' childhoods. Was it all worth it in the end?
He felt like he was fighting for something he believed in. And the fact that he won helped a lot. I think it was worth it for them because they felt Like, they not only won the right to produce these games, but Ralph also won the right to talk about it. And for him, the truth and the true story being out was really critical.
Obviously, this is an iconic game, and its origin story is also iconic. Have you heard from anyone who says, I just can't handle it, you're ruining my game?
No. And in fact, it's almost the opposite. I'm getting stories from people saying, my dad played in the 20s, or, you know, my great-grandfather. I feel like there's some people who might think I'm raining on their parade, but the people who are so excited about the whole pre-story being out there has definitely outweighed that.
It seems like there are now 1,000 varieties of Monopoly, Nintendo Monopoly, Doctor Who Monopoly, The Godfather Monopoly. Is this game more popular than ever?
I think it is, but I think it's been funny to watch. You mentioned some of these spinoff games. In a weird way, that's a return to what the game was before, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you think of the 1935 kind of classic Monopoly, but before that existed, people made things their own. Whenever I see different flavors of the game out there, I think, oh, this is so funny. People are imitating something like a century ago and have no idea that they're doing it.
Mary Pilon's new book is called The Monopolists, Obsession, Fury, and the Scandal Behind the World's Favorite Board Game. Mary, thanks for speaking with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Only a Game is produced by Doug Trabu. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. Our technical director is James Trout. Our intern is Keely Flanagan. We had help from Georgette DeFries at New England Public Radio. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from famous monopolist John D. Rockefeller, who in this 1932 newsreel challenges the country to pull itself out of the Great Depression.
Let us go forward to play our part worthily in building a better world.
Yeah, sure, but that's a bit easier when you already hold Park Place and Boardwalk, isn't it? I'm Karen Gibbon. Bill Littlefield will be back next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.